The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Bill, for that introduction. It honored me perhaps more than I am worth, but nonetheless, thank you for all those kind words. I'm to speak tonight on the subject of, can politics and religion mix? I guess a good way to begin might be just by reading that part of the First Amendment of our Constitution, which has to do with what has been called the wall of separation between church and state. And that First Amendment says, in part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. And that's the work of James Madison. I'd like to begin by talking about five dangers that seem to me that face us in our present period of concern about politics and religion. The first of those dangers, I think, has to be found with us who are evangelicals. I'm openly an evangelical, and that's my own particular theological position. And I think that we need to be careful at this point to remind ourselves that the whole idea of separation in church and state was been our thing. Not that no one else favored it. I'm sure that was true in the 18th century. Deists did as well. But I think we need to be reminded that a factor in the Revolutionary War was the concern of many people like us that the English government was going to send us an English bishop and sort of constitute all of us an English state church. And all throughout, especially the northern colonies, there was great concern about that, and that had an effect on the later disestablishment, really, of the churches in this country. Now, I also think that even from the beginning in New England, there was some recognition that the church and state should be separate. I recall that in the first few years after the Puritans arrived in numbers in the 1630s, they had come to a solid conclusion that you could not be both a church officer and an officer in the state. In other words, I couldn't be both a pastor and the mayor of Jenkintown at the same time. That they decided that we had much of that in Europe, we'll kind of get rid of that over here. Now later on, they kind of weakened that. I think they went back on it for a time, but at a subsequent period, they came down more firmly that there had to be some kind of separation between church and state. And then, a little later, there was not only the Baptist the Baptist experience in New England, where the Baptists discovered that some of the Puritans weren't too tolerant of them, and Roger Williams and others left. But also in Virginia, prior to the Revolution, there was a good deal of persecution of Presbyterians and Baptists by the established, or what was really an established church in Virginia, the English Church. And so I'm saying this just to mention that even in America, we evangelicals should have a concern that the separation between church and state not break down, for the very good reason that our whole system presupposes it. Let me use an illustration that might help you understand it. In Uganda, where for all practical purposes, there is an identification of the state with Christianity, you have a lot of the social problem comes out of that. And it makes it very difficult for the church really to be free. And it's not simply that somebody's standing over your shoulder looking down to you and telling you what to preach. That isn't true. I mean, no, that can happen. But rather, that when you get a situation in which everybody is a citizen, and to be a citizen you have to be a Christian, then everybody says he's a Christian to protect himself, and you've lost the distinctiveness of Christianity. You've reduced Christianity to culture. That's what you've done. And so I just want to say at the outset, it's really important that we who have our point of view recognize that we have a very deep vested interest in maintaining the distinction between the church and state. And of course, behind that is also our conviction that the scriptures teach such a principle, that we believe that God did not call Caesar to be God, or that he didn't call the church to run the state. And so these are things that we do need to remind ourselves at a time where there's a good deal of tension between politics and religion. Now, the second danger seems to me to be that, which is very unattractive to me, and that's the danger of polarization. A polarization in our society in which people kind of locate themselves each behind his own green line. Is that language familiar to anyone? Well, the green line is the line behind which the Christians stand in Beirut, and the Muslims are on the other side of the green line, and they put up barricades on that green line, and your relationship with the guys on the other side is mostly that of lobbing shells back and forth to keep the other guys awake and to know they still have enemies on the other side. And it seems to me a danger in American society that we will develop a kind of a Beirut series of relationships, the kind of people operating out of their own sociological, spiritual ghettos or whatever, in which they constantly relate to one another as groups, and they attack each other without any real communication. Now, you may not think that danger is real in America, and I hope it isn't real here, but I have lived in Uganda, and I spent some time in Ireland, and when you see a society where this is taken over, where the characteristic way of relating to people is out of deep polarization, you begin to think that maybe we should be careful to make sure that we're not doing this the wrong way. And I think there's some evidence that we aren't always doing that well. Now, if I may say, I don't know whether you are familiar with the book, but it's called The Holy Terror, The Fundamentalist War on America's Freedoms in Religion, Politics, and Our Private Lives, by Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman. Now, my impression is that their whole strategy is to show that we who are evangelicals or fundamentalists or reformed, whatever, that we're conducting a conspiracy, a long-range plan. And it's interesting, and speaking of the wall and separation of church and state, these authors would have the state intervene and get evangelical preachers off the television. So, and there's a whole sense that fundamentalists and evangelicals are conspiring, and something needs to be done about a very dreadful, dangerous thing. And it's sort of McCarthyism in reverse. Now, that's what I might say more on the left. Now, even on the evangelical side, this is really a good book, The Stealing of America by John W. Whitehead. Even the language, The Stealing of America, if I were to pick this up I wasn't committed to some of these things, and I've read that, I'd almost feel that he's saying there's a conspiracy out there on the other side. Now, sometimes, yeah, we do have our little conspiracies, I imagine, all around, but I think there's a danger of reading more into the other guy than you really should, so you're not really fair to him. So I think I'm really saying is, not only more than avoiding tendentious language, also, I think there's a matter almost of attitude which is involved in the picture. And if Robert Kramer, who's a state representative in Maryland, has said this in effect,
he says the danger in the relationship between politics and religion today is that both left and right are deifying their own positions and demonizing the other. I think that's pretty powerful. All too often, the debate both ways is being carried on with an attitude of pride conditioned by fear of the other side. What we need is to learn to disagree with the humility of Abraham Lincoln. He took his stand with grief, with the spirit of quiet submission to the providence of God. I like that. I like that very much. And I think that we don't want to then, on my part, I don't want to be treating other people as the enemy, the conspirers. I know we people, human beings, we do perhaps conspire a little bit, but I don't want to make somebody worse than he is. I don't want anybody to make me worse than I am. And so what I'm concerned about is the intensity of some of the things before us. I think you see it in our concern for pro-life, And perhaps sometimes with some of the moral majority people, that they're so burdened, so honestly concerned and grieved about these things, that sometimes it comes across almost in a threatening way. And I don't think we really want to do that. I don't think that's the part of humility to handle things that way. And the same thing with the holy terror. Man, if I didn't know any better, and I read that book, I would really be afraid of evangelicals. And I really would. I'd be almost terrorized after reading that book. So we don't want to get involved in that kind of thing any more than we can help. And really what I want to conclude on this second point is that a society such as ours requires mutual respect. Wherever you can give it, give it. It requires some love even for enemies and forbearance. And constantly learning to listen to one another. Now, I'm saying that out of a conviction that we have some traditions shared as Americans that are very precious and that we ought not lightly to throw away. Now, the third thing that seems to me a danger is that as the debate goes on of this kind, that we begin to omit concern for the person being debated about. One of the key issues in the church-state debate today has to do with abortion. And so here are people who are against it, and here people are for it. And the thought occurred to me as I was preparing this lecture, and here we have millions of American women who've had this abortion sitting there and listening to this debate almost as the forgotten people. Now, I don't mean they're completely forgotten. That's what the debate is about. But nonetheless, there are human needs there and concerns that we ought not just to lightly run by as we talk about it. And I was intrigued by Governor Cuomo's suggestion in his speech, which he recently gave in Indiana, and in which he said that pro-life and pro-choice people ought to cooperate in providing an alternative to abortion on demand. Now, I can't at this point quite see pro-life and pro-choice people cooperating on it, but I still think it's a good idea. And even though I don't agree with him on some basic things, I think the idea of, let's not forget the women who are involved here, and even the whole question of, no matter what you think about it, I don't think anyone who's done any counseling of women can overestimate the need for counseling for women who have had an abortion. In our own congregation here, we have had in the past women who've had as many as 3 abortions. And when you get and speak on abortion, you've got a very attentive audience. And so I think we need to develop a little more sensitivity in that area, maybe a lot more. And I would say the same thing even in the area of the whole question of homosexuality. The whole gay rights struggle, and it is a struggle, we have to admit that, even though I personally do not agree with the principles of the gay rights movement, I don't want to give the impression, I don't want anyone to take the impression from me that I, as an evangelical, am prejudiced against anybody. I mean, I want to have them know that they're welcome to my home, they're welcome to talk with me, and so on, that I'm an open person. If somebody hadn't been open to me, I would not be a Christian. And so I think that that sense of largeness of spirit ought not to be lost if we can help it. Then, the fourth matter is, I think we also need to consider in the picture today, as we try to get this in focus, is that the world today just isn't what it was a few years ago. And I think this is true of people on both sides of the issue, that my sense of many people who are more on the left or liberal side is they're really back in the 1930s or 50s, and sometimes I think we on the evangelical side, we're clear back to the beginning of the century. I mean, and that we haven't quite recognized where we are in time, space and time. And I think we as evangelicals have to see that a moral majority does not exist anymore, with all due respect to Jerry Falwell. I'm not quarreling with Jerry at all. I'm just saying I don't believe there is a moral majority anymore. I believe there's a very strong moral minority, and it's getting larger, but I think there's a nervous group in between who is open to persuasion, and but they've not been a part of a moral majority. I just think that's realism to see that. I think also, on the side of the evangelicals, we have to recognize that a cultural revolution has taken place which underlies some of these problems, and one is to do with the loss of the concept of virginity. I think that we have to recognize that that has disappeared from a lot of people's minds. It's not even recognized as an option. That's where we are. Now, I think we also have to recognize there's been a loss of absolutes generally, and it's part of this that makes it difficult as we go on to the fourth point for things to come together. And it's simply that laws will not make people righteous. And this is true both for the right and for the left. We're not going to, if there have been great cultural problems, if there's been what I would view as decline in morals, you can't simply legislate those morals back into existence. I don't think you can do that. Now, I don't mean that I don't favor just laws. I do, and I'm strongly for those, and I'm against anything I believe is unjust. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that America has gone through some great turnings. And what has happened is almost, if I may put it like this, it's almost, from my vantage point, as if there's been a great slide in moral and family values, and then with the evangelical revival, there's become a tension because now there are millions of people out there who want to see it changed. And I think that's a lot of what the tension is about, that suddenly I think the evangelicals had become a kind of a sliver, not just a minority, but then with this resurgence of evangelicalism, I would say the estimates of the size of the evangelical movement, I don't know how to evaluate them, but I have read some which would indicate that the evangelicals are at least as numerous as the members of the Catholic Church, and maybe more so, which is quite a change. As I say, I won't defend those statistics, but I have heard them. And so what you have then is under the surface in the situation is a clash of values, certain values emphasizing human rights, which we believe have created problems for family rights and obligations, and then that just taking over, and then suddenly a kind of a revival of evangelicalism trying to push it back. A lot of the problem is right here, a lot of the struggle. Now, having said that for the background, I want to bring what I think is the conflict itself between church and state into clear focus. And I want to talk now about the wall of separation as having developed mobility. And you see, the Thomas Jefferson used that language. He said there was should be a wall of separation between church and state. Now, I don't know whether I favor that language, wall of separation, but again, I hold firmly to the principle that there should be a separation between church and state. But what I think is the problem is the wall of separating church and state has not only been raised higher, but it's been moved in a particular direction. Are you following what I'm saying? This is kind of the key to what I think is the tension in the present situation. First of all, what has happened is that the Supreme Court in the 20th century has become a great power in American society. In some ways, it seems to me, on these areas which we're concerned, the Supreme Court has been exercising much more influence than the executive or the legislative branches of government. And if you take the development of the separation of church and state and how the Supreme Court has handled it, you will find that it's been very active and it's been very aggressive. How you interpret that, whether you're for it or against it, is another question. The thing I'm talking about here is that it has become unusually aggressive and active. And so the wall of the separation between church and state seems to be mobile. And my own conviction is that this mobile wall, whatever you want to call it, this moving of this wall, began in the 1920s when the Supreme Court began to read the 14th Amendment as extending the First Amendment to the states. Now, I'm not saying I even disagree with that. I'm just saying this was a radical development. Now, in the history of the country, the First Amendment, which set up the separation between church and state, had not been read quite in that way. For example, in Massachusetts, until 1833, the established church was the Congregational Church. That was the year that Massachusetts decided the Congregational Church was not going to have any special privileges. But it was in the 1920s that the First Amendment was applied to the states. Before that, it had been widely understood that the sense of the amendment was forbidding the federal government from adopting a state religion. And in the 20s, it was applied to the states. Now, I think there was a widespread consensus long before that this should be applied to the states. But I just want to show you how recent some of these developments are to give you an indication of the movement of things. Then, this became dramatic in 1962 and 63, when prayer and worship and compulsory Bible reading were removed from the public schools. That's familiar to many of us who have some roots around here, because some of that began in our own Abington High School. I think maybe not everyone recalls that, but that's one of the places where it began. And Madeline Murray and others are reasonably familiar to us. Then in the early 1970s, there was a change in relationship to certain traditional values in which the Supreme Court moved into them, that they extended in a case Eisenstadt and Baird, they extended unmarried persons the right to determine the appropriate use of contraceptives. Now, that might seem to be a minor thing, but the Supreme Court hadn't done anything like that before. This was new ground. They hadn't moved into such matters. And it was really a decision on issues before that had been family related and I believe not really permitted, not least legally. Then in 1973, the Supreme Court, in the case of Roe versus Wade, decided on the basis of right to privacy that abortion up to 6 months would be permitted to women. This was really based upon a new interpretation of the 9th or 14th Amendments. I have just this afternoon looked at the 9th and 14th Amendments. I have trouble finding it there, but they did. And they found the right to privacy there. And on that basis, they granted American women the right up to the 6 month to have an abortion. And, of course, it had to be based on a plea of of need or of help. But nonetheless, it was a right to privacy, which was the basis. Then, in 1976, in a case, Planned Parenthood versus Danforth, it was denied a law which required the husband's consent was necessary for abortion by the wife. So the wife could get an abortion now without her husband's agreement. There was another movement into the area of the family. And then in that same decision, it was denied that the written consent of parents for women under 18 was necessary to get an abortion. In other words, the parents' consent was not needed for a teenage girl to get an abortion. This was a related decision of the Supreme Court in 1976. Then, in 1977, the Supreme Court struck down laws forbidding sales of contraceptives to 16-year-olds and under. Now, the U.S., in related action, the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Sixth Circuit, held that family planning centers did not need to notify parents about their children using contraceptives or either supplying them. And so what you have today, and here's where I think the crisis comes in, today parents cannot legally prevent a child from getting an abortion or insist that family planning center not provide contraceptives. You can't do that anymore. You don't have that right. The Supreme Court has made that ruling. Now, at the same time, until just the last few days, that high school young people were viewed as too immature to handle religious pressures. Now, they could get the abortion, they could use contraceptives, but they were too immature to handle religious pressures, and you couldn't have after-school Bible clubs, you couldn't have prayer before or after school, etc. And the reasoning was that while that's proper on a university level, that when you're in the high school, you can't handle that. And some of us naturally felt the irony of that, that they were given these tremendous freedoms, which traditionalist-minded people like myself wouldn't think they could handle. And at the same time, they were denied, well, let me put it to you this way. Until this recent law was passed, I was not permitted to go on the in the local high school after school and talk about Christ. But if a group of young people on that same campus decided they wanted to organize a Marxist club, they could invite a Marxist speaker. Now, I'm not saying that to be alarming. I'm just saying what the situation was. Now, there has been a law passed by Congress, Equal Access Law, and it makes it possible. Now, you can hold prayer meetings and religious meetings or a Bible club before or after school. So that's now permitted. But you see, what I'm trying to get you to see is the Supreme Court has been making decisions, and these decisions, I think the people like myself who are conservative evangelicals and who hold to traditional values handed down in our society for many years, we feel the wall has been coming at us. And even if you don't agree with me, I just want you to understand a little bit my point of view. I'm not trying to attack anyone, just to get people to kind of understand a little bit of the concern here. Now, when you get a picture like that going, and then you have a very activist American Civil Liberties Union threatening to sue school boards, you get sort of super careful interpretations of even what the Supreme Court said, and so is a further wall created between us and evangelicals and the public schools. Now, I don't want to go into all the history of that. I think it's intriguing, but it's part of the picture. So what develops then is this wall keeps moving, and we feel that something needs to be done about it. Now, there are also related areas where we as evangelicals see the wall as moving at us. And one of those happens to be with the IRS. Now, every patriotic American dislikes the IRS, and I'm sure that on this point, I'll get all your sympathies, no matter where you stand on these issues. But I'm teasing a bit. It's too far away from April 15th to have you anti-IRS. But anyway, the IRS has been moving into the church. Now, part of this is quite understandable, because in order to get tax-exempt status, ingenious Americans have been incorporating as churches, you know, and they have done it across the country. And so the IRS has been, I think, properly concerned about this. But in their zeal, what has been happening is that they have really been going after people and churches in a way that really brings the state right in the front door. And I don't think this is generally known to the American public. For example, in 1980, a pastor of an independent Bible church in Texas was jailed by a federal district judge because he refused to give the IRS access to all its records. And you know, when you just run around and lightly put pastors in jail, I think that's going quite a ways. Now you say, yeah, what's the whole point of it? And well, I think the point of it was he refused to give them access to all the church records. They wanted all the records, the names and addresses of church members, contributors, and they had an extensive questionnaire. They wanted to know about the whole life of the church. And now, later on, in an appeal, the church partially won, but they were still required to give IRS information. Now, you see, this can be a dark gray area, but what you get here is an aggressive government moving in, and with the courts not overly sensitive, to say the least, about what the state is doing, plunging in here. Now, in another way, this has happened in relationship to private schools and the churches. You see, particularly Baptist churches. Now, I'm not a Baptist, I'm Presbyterian, but particularly Baptist churches tend to incorporate a Christian school within their church. And now what that means is that if you have a Christian school and a church and they're identified and that's their system, that if the state is going to do anything about the school, they're going to be doing it to the church. Now, in 1981, the state padlocked the doors of Faith Baptist Church in Louisville, Nebraska. The pastor was eventually jailed along with other church members, and the reason was the school was run by the church and the state wanted a licensed school. They wanted to certify the teachers and approve the curriculum. And, you know, Baptists are not easily pushed around. I don't know whether you know that, but it goes with the breed. And so they went to jail in significant numbers, and we had the awesome spectacle in our country of the government of the state of Nebraska locking up a Baptist pastor and then others who joined him and holding them in prison, and his actually leaving the state and fleeing from that state and even passed through this area. And to me, that's alarming that would take place. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a judge of all the fine points of the case. Where you draw the line, where does the state have the right to license, where doesn't it? I tend to say, as long as you can show that the children are performing well academically and there's a proper quality to the education, the state has no business being in there. There's no laws being broken. I think we ought to lean over backwards on that. I don't think that's happening. I think the pressure is all the other way. And I would cite the problems at present in the state of Maine, where there has been a real contest over this matter of the schools and state authority. Okay, now, having said that, what I'm trying to give you then is this picture of this moving wall. And then, of course, what has happened is that over against it, there has been a mounting vocal opposition. And a lot of it has come from a couple of sources. In the area of abortion, it's been the Catholics, with especially the Catholic bishops. In the area of abortion, homosexual rights, the matter of these schools and registration, and in other areas, pornography, it's been evangelicals. And so what we have then is a kind of a, and this is the third major point I want to make, is a mounting vocal opposition. Now, I want to say that in this area of mounting vocal opposition, you can see Geraldine Ferraro and Mr. Mondale and Mr. Cuomo, and they're trying to deal with a problem, and they're kind of caught in the vortex of it and almost being sucked under. And so the question is, people just keep saying the same things back and forth now. And I have a stack of things at home on this present controversy, and almost all of them come out the same place. And what the place is with Geraldine Ferraro is that she believes, and so does the governor of New York, that personally I support pro-life measures, I'm not for abortion, and so on, but then publicly I must have a different stand as an elected official, that I may not seek to impose what our church values upon the American public as a whole. And then she runs head-on into the pro-life people, and Cuomo had his contact with him just, I guess, over the weekend, where he sent the this Nathaniel, the Nazarene family home, which is for mothers who are unwed. He sent them the check for $1,500 that he got for his speaking in Indiana, and they turned it down. Not because it bounced, but rather because they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So there's this conflict going on, and it's almost at times kind of seething, and it goes around and around, and he expresses his position, and Geraldine Ferraro does, and then Mr. Mondale does, and then you hear in the background Mr. Reagan. He must be enjoying all of this, I would say. He's expressing his position, but it doesn't seem to be gelling with anybody learning anything. Now, I don't mean to be saying, well, now I have the answer to all their problems. I think they have genuine differences among them. But I think what we have to say is that the final line of the problem, the bottom line, is are there or are there not religious absolutes which underlie our civilization, our country, and our Constitution? You see, there's where your cleavage is. Now, I don't mean by this to suggest that I think everything I believe or you believe is worthy of being called an absolute. I mean, some of us are just absolutist personalities, and we're absolutely right on everything, and so on, gray areas, white, whatever it is. We know the answers. I'm not talking about that kind of argumentative, opinionated thing, but are there fundamentals like the Ten Commandments which underlie our Constitution and make it possible? In other words, if you read our Constitution, honestly, our Constitution would scare me to death if I didn't believe there were absolutes underneath it. For example, what do I mean? Well, this constant refrain, due process, you may not deprive anyone of life without due process. Well, if you put that in a void with no moral values, it means you can't kill anybody without a trial. But if there's not something back there about justice and truth and all the rest, more foundational, what in the world does that mean? Even Hitler was quite willing to give people a trial. Stalin did too. They used due process to some extent. And the very fact of due process, I do not think, unless you have some kind of system of absolutes, the Constitution makes any sense. And that's the issue for Reagan, and that's the issue for, we almost forgotten about Bush, he's back there somewhere, and the others. The whole issue happens to be, are there absolutes or they're not? Now, I think here is where we have the conflict. And if we don't have it here, all the rest will just kind of go by us. Because the answer for Geraldine Ferraro, who has said that that she personally does not favor abortion, she wouldn't want an abortion, yet but she wouldn't want to force that on others. Well, that position, you see, is that valid? That's the fundamental question. And myself, I think that it isn't, because this country came out of a context in which there were absolutes, and we only got the freedom because it was written in the Bible, you should not kill, shouldn't do any murder. And if you take that away from behind the Constitution, you know, you can say there's a web of state laws guaranteeing that and so on. But if there are no absolutes, why can't you change those laws and bring in another Holocaust? And I think that there's some signs with the whole euthanasia movement that this might be just exactly what could happen. Now, I think if you look then at this principle of whether there are absolutes or not is the crisis, then that is what you should see as fueling both Catholic opposition and evangelical opposition to the movement of the Supreme Court. I have to say to all of you, I as an evangelical feel I'm being invaded. Now, you may not feel that way, but I feel that all that I have stood for is being threatened. Now, I don't say that in a harsh way. I just say, to deal with the realities of the situation, I think you can't go on with the current press for permissiveness without sometime the whole bottom falling out of our civilization. And that is my point of view. Now, if we look at it more closely, I want to point out areas where I think this conflict is coming to the fore with creating a lot of tension, and where the religious absolutes are fueling mounting vocal opposition. First of all, in the area of the moral failure of the public schools. Now, don't misconstrue that. If anyone's a reporter and wants to quote me, let hear the whole thing. I'm not at all saying that everybody involved in the public schools is in a moral mess. I didn't say that at all. But I think what we have got to admit that American young people are having terrific problems in our time. I mean, I think the drugs and the promiscuity, I think the cheating, even the violence in some schools, that it seems to me the public school education has a very simple task, and that simple task is to hand on the heritage. And you can't hand on the heritage if, and I want to bring out this one thing, which I have seen being taught by many teachers in the public schools, and it's been taught in churches and all the rest, but I think it's very destructive of society. And it's this: when your absolute becomes the I, the ego, you're going to destroy society. And the trend in the last 20 years in the public school system and the church and many places else has been towards self-fulfillment. I think the book by Daniel Rinkelevich, I never can pronounce his name quite right, New Rules, ought to be read by everyone, in which he says that the rage has been for self-fulfillment. Do your first duty is to yourself. Well, I grew up, boy, my parents said, your first duty is not to yourself. And when you start doing that, boy, I don't know what they'd have done to me. I would never have dreamed of even saying that. You know, if you said that, I can just imagine the look on their faces. My duty is to myself, you know. oh, brother. And we knew where the duty lay. It lay in others. I was taught that we must have that first concern for others. You are not an absolute. Now, I disagreed with that, of course, because I felt I was an absolute. There's plenty of that in all of us. But if you fuel that by teaching, I think you're going to have moral anarchy. And I don't want to limit that just to public schools. I think it's in private schools, and perhaps in some private schools even worse. And I think Christian schools, too, have had to struggle with it. But the point I want to make is that when the absolute becomes your own I, however inflated you want to make it, and it's over against the absolutes of God, you've got a struggle going on, and that's where we are. And then the second thing, it seems to me, with abortion, what brings so much tension into the picture is that for many of us, I think this is well for Jewish people to know, we're much more sensitive to the Holocaust than some of my Jewish friends think we are. I've talked with them about this. I've visited Dachau. I know at least one elder in church has visited Dachau. And I've read a great deal of literature on the Holocaust. And my underlying concern is that it doesn't come here in a new way and begin with the unborn babies. Because, you see, it's not only a matter of compassion, But also, I believe the central issue here again is a baby, even though unborn, the unborn baby, is that a human being, someone made in the image of God, and therefore, have you committed a crime against God's absolutes when you perform an abortion? You see, there's the issue. Now, you may not agree with me. You may say, well, it's only a fetus, a blob of tissue, and life, human life doesn't begin till birth or whatever. But here is certainly an issue, and it's one where the conflict drives us out into the public life. And I think what happens is that those who sort of from the outside look at us evangelicals, and they see, you know, here's Jerry, you can't turn the television on. Without looking at a Jerry Falwell or somebody else, you know. So here's Mr. Average American. He turns on the television, and here's Jerry Falwell looking him eyeball to eyeball. And then he drives up the street, and he sees a group of people out in front of Abingdon Hospital picketing, and he says, "Good night. The fascists have arrived." You know, I can understand that feeling. But it isn't coming out of that. It's an attempt to preserve, really, the distinction between the church and state, not to throw it away, because we think that the state has invaded some areas that they had no right to invade. At least that's our point of view. That's how we see it. Now, also, the concern of lawlessness in respect to the family. I think I knew at least a dozen years ago that sexual abuse of children in this area, I'm not talking about the inner city, I think it's bad in the inner city, but sexual abuse of children in our area was very close to an epidemic. I'm talking about parents sexually abusing their children. At least a dozen years ago, I was aware of it just by the sheer number of teenagers and grown women who came and talked to me about the problem. Now, I say epidemic. I don't know how bad it was because I don't know whether there's any real statistics on it, but it's bad. And then, for me, it's a deep-seated concern, the whole trend towards unisex. Now, I don't care how you cut your hair. Maybe even I have a unisex haircut, I can't tell anymore. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. But I think that what we have to say is sexual identity. Is that an absolute? Are we confusing people for a lifetime by telling them that these things are relative? I think those are issues, you see, that we're concerned about. And it alarms me when Walter Mondale says, if elected president, I will, within the first 3 months of my administration, issue executive orders banning discrimination in federal government employment on the basis of sexual orientation. Well, I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I don't think that we ought to be interfering with the human and civil rights of people. If they're doing a job well, if they're people of integrity, you know, no matter who they are, I mean, I'm not against them. But I think you have to say this question now comes to the fore, is there something inherently wrong with homosexuality and lesbianism? Now, the Bible says there is. Now, you can take the Bible if you want and say, well, guys like Jack Miller, John Miller, are just proof texting. They're taking those out of context. Don't believe it. There is no scholarly basis you can find, no basis that scholarship of an authentic kind can find in the Bible for saying that the Bible accepts homosexuality as normal. It does not. I mean, the plain language is there, and no matter what you say about it, it won't mean anything other than what I've said. And I've done pretty careful research on it. And I'm willing to challenge through a debate anyone who argues otherwise. And I think I can win. I just think you'd have to make a very false and phony case. And so, what I'm saying then is, again, the Bible has said there's something built into creation in these principles of sexual identity. If you're made a man or a boy, God made you that way. If you're made a woman, God made you that way. And you can't be something else. Now, I don't want to defend male machoism in the United States. I don't want to be seen as endorsing chauvinism or anything of that kind. But I do say there's some absolutes here, and these are tensions point. Well, now, the final tension point, which comes up in the matter of church and state, has been brought up by Ronald Reagan himself. And this is where it gets sticky. Because, in effect, what he's saying is, I am pro what? Life? He's saying that. And he's saying, I want those people who believe in absolutes to vote for me. Now, the problem in that, of course, is that we evangelicals don't want to be reduced to a wing of the Republican Party, right? Right? I think there's a problem there. I feel uncomfortable with that. And I also am sympathetic to the thought that here in the United States, we need to keep a balance, and I hate to see things polarized in the way that I have been warning about earlier in the lecture. At the same time, when you begin to look at it, you have to say, whatever may be his motives, good or bad, that we find a crisis on our hands, because for the first time, we have a president who has clearly taken a stand on family rights. You see, there's the issue. And whatever I may think about politics, here's suddenly someone who has said, I in effect, believe in absolutes. Now, the danger of this kind of thing is that we'll get a deeper polarization in our society, and it will lead to that kind of situation that I warned about. And so I would say that each of us must search his or her conscience and decide how he should vote or she vote in the election. But I think you can't set aside that if you evaluate this matter as a serious one, if you do believe that that the abortion of what is it, a million and a half children per year, if that's something like a Holocaust, and if these other problems are contrary to the law of God and so on, that you can't set that aside in the picture. And when you come to vote, you're going to have to take it into account between your God and your conscience. And that's really where it is. I myself would agree with Archbishop O'Connor, who got himself shot at rather roundly for saying it, but I'll say I agree with him, that I would agree that I personally could not vote for somebody who was pro-choice. I would have great trouble doing that. I don't think I could. And my conscience wouldn't permit me. But having said that, I want to bring things to a close now by saying, okay, well now, where's the boundary practically? Where's this wall? Where do I think it should be? Where do you think it should be? Well, we'd have a couple of minutes for discussion, but I want to run over a few areas that where I think that we can get some agreement on, and maybe some disagreement too. We need both. First of all, I think we all in America ought to agree we don't want an established church. I think everyone ought to say that. We've got enough sad experience of what happened in Europe. We don't want to repeat it, do we? And if you've seen the state churches of Europe, you know, my father-in-law went back to the church of which his father was a pastor. And it was a Sunday, I think, after Easter, a couple Sundays after Easter. It was in Denmark. And it was a big church. Everybody had been there on Easter, but when they came a couple of weeks after, and he went to the service, here he is in this big stone-like cathedral. How many people do you guess were in the congregation? Two. A woman on the other side and a woman, and he on this side. He says, you feel really conspicuous. Well, now, I believe that goes back to state church religion, and I don't think anybody here ought to advocate that. And I think we also ought to say we don't want state-supported religious intolerance. We really don't want anyone to feel that he's a second-class American because he's not my religion. I just think we want to avoid that feeling. We don't want to make anyone feel second or third class. And then we also, I don't want any school prayers written by the state of Pennsylvania. I do not want them. I think we ought to agree on that. I think it might be a little harder to get agreement on this. But I don't think we ought to put the state in the business of writing school prayers. I think that's exactly crossing the line. And then, I think, though, I would favor also care if there's a period of silence at the beginning of a class day, the beginning of a school day, I would want to use great care if that's an opportunity for some to pray that a minority not be asked to leave or something to put them on the spot. I would want to be sensitive to that. I would really prefer voluntary prayer before school, or if in school hours during a period of silence where each person is free during that time either to pray or not to pray, but no written prayers. And then also, I think there ought to be no restrictions on religious discussions in school hours. It ought to be the same as in the university, guided by the principal and proper authorities in a neutral atmosphere. I don't see how you can talk about Western literature. I don't think there's all kinds of things you can't talk about without saying something about the history of the culture. And then it seems to me that I think the state, by interpreting to the Supreme Court the Constitution to permit abortion on demand or on choice, has permitted a crime that God's law has forbidden. And I believe that unborn life, human life, is a divine right, and Supreme Court has erred, and it's invaded really a domain. I'm not saying exactly the church, it's invaded really a divine domain. I also think if you read the action of the Supreme Court in deciding against abortion, that they didn't seem to have much knowledge of human biology either. It was kind of amazing. Mr. Abortion, or Dr. Abortion, is Nathanson, and he criticized the Supreme Court decision, even though he was a major figure behind it, that they simply didn't seem to be aware of human biology, how it worked in the birth process. Right, so having said that then, the final thing I'd like to say is what action do we take? Well, on my part, I think I always want to have any action I take conditioned by forgiveness. I think you can feel at times I get talking about stuff and I get a little hot, you know. I've got to get worked up. Well, if you just go around getting hot, and I can see people on the left going around getting hot, people on the right getting hot, Catholics getting hot, Protestants getting hot, pretty soon we're going to get a shootout going. We can't have that. We just can't afford it. What we need is to practice forgiveness. You see, at the beginning I spoke of these attitudes we wanted to avoid, and it seems to me that John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Now that means God loves everybody, doesn't it? All mankind? I think that's right. It doesn't mean that I know everybody's going to become a believer or is, you know, one of God's people. I don't say that. But it means God has a love for mankind. And shouldn't I have the same? And when God looks at me, when he judges sins, something I might think is a terrible sin in another person, who knows exactly how God compares that with my sins? A man once asked me if I was a hypocrite. And I didn't say anything in answer, because in some degree I am. And so are you. The biggest hypocrites are those who don't know it. If you want to show me a big hypocrite, get me a man who says I am not a hypocrite. There is one. We all have great inconsistencies. And we all live before the living God, and therefore we ought to be very careful in our attitudes. And if we see an attitude that God has of love and forgiveness, well then we ought to have an attitude of love and forgiveness too. And it sure would make a lot better world, wouldn't it? All right, then the other thing is this, that the proof of our concern in these areas is got to be giving to the wrong, to those who are wrong and wrong, to those who are suffering. In the case of abortion, we ought to really be concerned about and reach out to them. And I've tried to do the same thing with friends that I have won among the gay groups. You know, my natural instinct isn't to do that. I remember once I got on this plane and one of the gay rights church leaders sat down next to me. And I thought, what did I do to deserve this? You know, and he began to try to evangelize me for gay rights and me for John 3:16. And the poor businessman next to him, I had great pity on him. I mean, he must have thought, what did I get into, you know? Refund my money, let me out. But anyway, the thing was, as I listened to him, the conclusion came to me, I don't think like him in many ways. My background is different from him in many ways. I mean, it even makes my stomach upset to listen to him. And but then, as I listened to him, I said, you know, but basically we're alike in one crucial respect. He's living for his own glory. And the whole thing he's talked about is pride and pride and pride. And it's for his own glory. And that's the way I am by nature. I love to be number one, right? You do too, come on. And so if we just have a little humility and recognize that God's love has been so great that he gave Christ to die for our sins, then it's got to have some softening, loving effect in the way we give and care for people. And it doesn't have to be compromising. It doesn't have to compromise principles or that which you believe is true, but it certainly can go a long ways in just kindness. And then the third thing is, I think we have to keep dialogue going with the opposition wherever we possibly can do it. We ought to try to communicate. And one of the reasons of this meeting tonight is that we might communicate to folks. We might interact a bit. And then the other thing, as I said, vote. And that's between God and you and your conscience. And then, as we who pick it, let's make sure we pick it in an orderly fashion and do so without wrath or anything like that and see it as part of our right. And if you even engage in civil disobedience, and some Christians have in our time, I'm very slow to jump on that bandwagon, but nonetheless, some people have. Even then, you should do it in an orderly way and be prepared to accept the consequences. If I have to visit you in jail, just let me know ahead of time what you're planning to do, okay? Or if I'm planning to end up in jail, I'll let you know ahead of time what I'm planning to do. But really, what I'm pleading for then is so much a lot of it, holding fast to principles, being strong for what you believe is right, but then being compassionate towards people. And that's the end. Question time is here. I both agree with it and it scares me to death. The question is, it's from Fran Schaefer's book, and the question is, should Christians take a more militant stand, including civil disobedience or even more, when a major crime, is being committed by a government that's proved tyrannical? And I would say this, before you're going to do something like that, come and talk to one of the elders. Please. My reason is this, though I think I accept the principle. For example, let's go back to Germany in the 30s. I think there was a point where Christians should have reacted much more strongly. I think the church should have gone into politics much more vigorously. I was really pleased at Dachau to see that something like 2,600 pastors had been in there. Now, I think that's quite unusual, though. And that was mostly Catholic. But I think Protestantism had lost its absolutes, which is interesting, isn't it? Because it had lost its absolutes in Germany, it couldn't take a stand. And so I think, yeah, in a situation like that, you ought to start by taking a stand. Now, how do you do it? Well, if you can vote, I think that's where you start. And if you can picket, that's where you start. Do you ever take steps further, like getting up in front of the hospital? I don't want to give you ideas now. But, you know, the things that have been done by pickets in the past, we've all seen them, where they get a chain and chain themselves to the hospital, or they get a human chain and handcuff one another to each other and to the gates, whatever. So the police have an awful time letting anyone in. I think that there might be a place for that if you've exhausted every channel. But I certainly don't think you ought to commit one crime to solve another.
In other words, I think it would be dreadful if you went up and said, well, these people at Einstein or wherever, there are a lot of abortions going on, or an abortion clinic, and I'm going to go there and I'm going to abduct the doctors. You know, I think that happened, didn't it? I think it happened at one clinic in the Midwest. I don't think you ought to do that. No, I mean, you don't do evil that good may come or fight evil with evil. I think you have to be very careful of that. I think there's a needed here combination of prudence and wisdom and to exhaust the means that are at hand. I don't think we've done that by any means. Yes. The question is, to which does the Christian owe obedience? To the Constitution, which is more fixed, which is a written document, or to the federal government, which is sort of in an evolutionary flow, or even actually committed to evolutionary principles. I don't know whether I go as far as to say the last was true. I don't know that. But you pointed a deep problem in American life. You see, American Constitution is different from a British Constitution in that basically our constitutions have been written and theirs have been unwritten, understood. But now what has happened with that constitutional history, with the Supreme Court really becoming the arbitrator more and more of the Constitution's meaning, there's come to be sort of a development of an understood Constitution as well. So it's a little bit fuzzy in my mind. But I think, to make a short and simple answer, my feeling is that it's a Christian is to stick more by the letter of the law, the written Constitution, and that if you make the Constitution just mean anything, it means then you have almost destroyed it as a document. For instance, if the Ninth Amendment and the 14th teach the right to privacy as a basis for choice abortion, boy, you've done some magic with words to get that out of there. At least I'm really stupid because I can't see it in there. And so on. Yes. Yes, well, of course, this is a very complicated matter because the Supreme Court and the court system, I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that I recall reading that grants the rights of the courts to have judicial review. But from the beginning, even from John Marshall, they've practiced it and they have struck down laws. Now, the question then comes up, what do you do with the authority of the Supreme Court when it is really making legislation? And I think that my own approach would be that comes down to the present election. Let's face it, why is the present election important? It isn't because I think that Reagan is a great economist, or I believe in supply-side economics. I mean, I just hold my breath when I listen to either Mondale or Reagan talk about economics. anybody up there impress me all that much, but I think the issue is whoever gets elected this time is likely to appoint four justices, and that's part of the tension in the picture. It's why a lot of people are registering. And it isn't simply a matter anymore of Mondale versus Reagan, but it's rather a case of what's the future in regard to Supreme Court. And I think that's part of where the decisive thing is going to lie. The other thing, it would seem to me, would be I'm not enough of a legal expert to tell you what the other things would be. I'll just stop there. Another question, yes. Matters of foreign policy. Dear me. The question is, would I care to comment on the matter of foreign policy? Well, I'll say a couple of things. And one of those things has to do with Jerry Falwell. And I have been asked, what do I think about Jerry Falwell? And I'm an admirer of Jerry Falwell. But I have a problem seeing the connection between the Bible and what he seems to see as the mandate to build a stronger and stronger Army, Navy, and Air Force. I mean, I can't quite get that out of my Bible necessarily. I think proper defense is part of the police powers in Scripture and so on.
But he sees the Christian position should involve just sort of almost wholesale support for that kind of development. I have difficulty with that. And I also think in the matter of nuclear freeze, which is one of the big issues, that, boy, that's a complex question. Because I think anyone in his right mind or her right mind ought to favor not only freezing nuclear weapons, but reducing their number. I mean, if anybody isn't for that, come up and tell me why. I mean, I think that this is so. Now, I think the problem comes in, and I think some of the right haven't seen the value of reducing these things, but some on the left, or wherever you call some of these sides, have not seen the difficulty which we're faced with a Soviet government. You know, I've waded through Solzhenitsyn's things, I've had a course or two in Russian history and so on, and those guys in the Kremlin, you know, you can never tell which one is going to be awake and alive. I mean, even that scares me. And their record of human rights is so abominable, and their record of deception is so long, it's so historic, that side of it scares me too. And so I find myself in a dilemma. And I tell you what I do. Now, you may say, boy, you're copping out. But I say, I pray. And I pray for the Russian leaders too. And I pray for the American leaders. And I pray that they won't do something stupid. I mean, I think that prayer is the most crucial thing, and we ought not to neglect it. But some of those things bother me both ways. And I think a Christian ought not to lightly run in there and support everything in front of him. I have great trouble with the whole idea of the use of weapons since Civil War. The whole idea of just mass gunning of people down. I mean, the way war has been fought, building bigger and bigger weapons. I think that there's got to be an alternative or two. I won't try to develop those tonight. Okay, I saw a hand up over here somewhere. I see we are running out of time. Yes.
You can't point to their religious.
Okay, well, I was used speaking popularly tonight. I wasn't trying to refine the nomenclature. I agree with you completely. The question is, am I being unwise in my sort of identifying as synonyms religion and church, established denominations? And I don't feel particularly unwise in that. I think it's a way to communicate to the people who are here. But I do think your point is well taken that humanism is a religion. It's a taking of something out of the Christian faith, the freedom ideal, out of the Christian faith, and sort of making it into a god. And that's why you have all the permissiveness and do your own thing. It's an outworking of this Christian freedom ideal borrowed. It is a religious concept. It's not religious in that it has a formal worship structure, though. It's much more amorphous than that. All right? Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you said that because what you thought I said is not what I thought I said. I was saying I was surprised that he had moved in so strongly into this area. I'm still surprised. I didn't expect him to do so. And I think it does become a problem and a practical one in that I would hate to see evangelicals simply reduced to a wing of the Republican Party. I would hate to see that happen. That's what I was talking about. I would like, I'm writing letters to the Democratic leaders on this. I'm entreating them not to do some things they're doing because they are doing that, in effect. In other words, I'm saying I see this develop with grief. But it doesn't mean I don't agree with President Reagan. Of course I agree with him on that. I'm just a little concerned about getting this so politicized, though, that people are going to be fighting at each other in the wrong spirit. But I'm not disagreeing with his stand against abortion. Do you understand me now? Yeah, well, I was surprised. I mean, not I don't say in a wrong way or in a bad way. I was just surprised. I was, and in some degree, I say I'm really pleased by his stand. But I also say there are other factors out there that we don't want to forget in our enthusiasm, so we don't get unconsciously an identification that evangelicals and Republicans are just one and the same. I fear that. I think we ought to see that we're going to have to live a little longer than this, and we got to be a little, just a little wise in some of these matters. Well, I think this, that my own stand is that I, as a Christian, believe in the value of having a strong army or navy in order to defend our country. I think that's part of the police powers of the state. And I felt it had gone weak under the former administrations. And, I personally voted for Reagan. Well, that's the problem. You see, I said, on the one hand, we desperately need to control atomic weapons. On the other side, we got a problem. How can we trust Russia on the basis of their record? I think we got this is the problem. Bill, I think you're trying to shut us up. That's a tough question.
We're
Okay, well, here's what I would say. Remember my talk. I said what to do is to maintain your absolutes, but to do it with an attitude and a spirit of great compassion for others. And I think Jerry Falwell has been a compassionate man, but I think there are others around who are not being so compassionate. I wouldn't say that we've done all we could, any of us, in the area of compassion. And I think that what I really, let me just pour my heart out to you a little bit. I don't want a situation like in Ireland or Uganda. I don't want a situation like in France. Jean Boyer, who's a good friend of mine, said, he says, boy, Jack, he says, don't give in to what's happened in France. He says, in our country here, we have such alienation among the classes. And if you're on this side, you're on the right, and you're really on the right. And if you're on the left, you're really on the left. And these people don't speak to one another. They're arm's length, they're sword's length. And so I think there's a special responsibility, and I'm especially thinking about Jewish people too. I've talked to Jewish friends, and they see Jerry Falwell on TV, and they say, fascist, the Holocaust is coming. And I think we need to reassure them that that isn't happening. And I think, I'm not saying that Jerry Falwell has done that, but I think that we need to provide a context for our speaking, and a context of compassion and concern, and to advertise that as much as the absolutes. Does that make sense to anybody? Okay, well, I'm not asking you to agree, but I mean...
I think we'll just ask Dr. Miller to...
Heavenly Father, we thank you for our nation. And we thank you for every group of people in it. We thank you for those who are very different from us. We thank you for those that we believe are really wrong. And we ask you, Lord, that you would have mercy in our whole country, on us. We know that there are many sins and weaknesses in us. And that sometimes we may have had attitudes that were proud and patronizing, and that we may have felt superior to others. For that, we ask you to forgive us. And even, Lord, when we're most right, we don't want to be most dangerous. We ask you that when we perceive that we're right and that we have the absolutes, that we may be very humble and that we may stand for truth both daringly and boldly and yet also with great compassion, and that we may not think that because we have an infallible Bible that we're infallible people. Grant us, Lord, to see there are many cracks in each of us, and each day we need grace. And therefore, grant that where we have seen crimes committed, we've all seen many, we ask you that you would grant to us to humble ourselves and reach out to those who are both victims and those who are victimizers. We pray especially about this great issue of abortion. We pray that you might bring it to a halt. We pray especially for the women who are getting the abortions. Lord, we're forgetting that people are doing this voluntarily and that it's because of a loss in the hearts of a knowledge of God. And so we pray for American women and men
that they would recover a knowledge of God. And then we do ask you tonight that what we have said here may be taken in good part by each one, that what is helpful may become very helpful. If anything is not helpful, that it may be discarded. And we trust our way to you. In Jesus' name, amen.